dietitian was asked a while back by one of her clients, "What do you think is the most dangerous food of all?" This woman who'd been divorced recently thought for a minute and said, "That's easy. Wedding cake." And for some people, that's the way it is. Sadly, many people get married not just for better or for worse, but rarely for long. The average marriage in the state of Kentucky only lasts 8 years, according to just last year's research, just 1 year better than the national average of 7. And 30% of all marriages fail within the first 2 years. And as bad as the divorce rate is in this country, I'm just as concerned at what they refer to in the literature as the marriage failure rate. And that is people who stay together long term, have no intention of getting a divorce, but stay together pretty much unhappily. Only 17% of marriages where people have been married and together 20 years or longer, do both parties rate that relationship highly satisfactory? And what I think is most tragic is that the state of marriages in the Lord's church is only slightly better than our counterparts in the world. One thing is certain, if you just go with the flow, if you don't give your marriage special attention and concern, over time, you tend to grow apart, your needs are not met, there's poor communication, and your theme becomes the righteous brothers, you've lost that loving feeling. And when you do that, you've lost something extremely precious. And of course, a Christian marriage, whose marriage has gone stale, is certainly not giving glory to God. And when it comes to serving Christ, and when it comes to our marriages, mediocrity ought not to be an option. As a young evangelist, I had a lot of people come to me with marriage challenges. Adam's probably already gone through sometimes feeling overwhelmed with that kind of need and wondering, how can I best help these couples? And oftentimes I felt rather ill-equipped and didn't know for sure how to go about best giving couples the tools they needed to resurrect their love. I asked last night how many in the audience knew of couples, either in their neighborhood or in their family or perhaps even in the church, that are having some pretty serious family problems. And about half the congregation raised their hand. In some audiences around the country, 2/3 or 3/4 raised their hands. Family problems are just epidemic in proportions all around us. And so tonight is going to be a rather different type of lesson. It's not a typical sermon. This is more of a class where I'm going to do my best to help equip the saints, as Paul said that we should, and help people to be able to serve other couples and families that are having difficulties. Jude 24 talks about snatching souls out of the flame, out of the fire, before it's too late. And there's a lot of families all around us that are about to be shattered. And we need to know, what can I do to help them before it is too late? We talk a lot in our brotherhood about divorce and remarriage, and certainly those are important doctrinal issues to discern. But I think we need to talk even more about marriage and how we can preserve and protect the marriages we have, instead of just sort of passively waiting until marriages break up and then figure out, what do we do now that Humpty Dumpty's already fallen off the wall? And it seems to me that the only real solution that pleases God is prevention. I mean, even if you've got scriptural grounds for divorce, somebody has still sinned. And God still hates divorce. And it's a sad day, even when one party has grounds. I've tried a lot of different things over the last 25 years. Some with some success, and some with not so much success. I always believe that results demand respect. And I've been looking for something that was practical and that was relatively easy to understand and to use that can help couples and families get on the right track. And I've held marriage seminars around the country, but up until recently, I've not really shared in my public seminars like this what I do behind the scenes in counseling that I've found on a personal level to be the most effective. And over the last 10 years or so, this particular paradigm that I'm going to share with you tonight has had about an 80% success rate when both couples have a marriage that's in crisis, but they both are working together to save it. It's not as high as I would like, but that is much better than most folks are doing out there. And I think it is easy and simple so that there's no reason that other people can't benefit from what it took years for me to find and to sort of tweak in a way that I believe is biblical and sound. Some of you may, when you hear this tonight, say, well, that's just common sense. And you know, a lot of this is just common sense. But the problem is, in many people's lives, common sense is not common practice. And that's what tends to get people into trouble. So we're going to talk tonight about a marriage that works. And the basic principle is really very simple. And that is that both parties need to learn to care for each other. Now, when you think about caring for your spouse, I want you to think in terms of meeting your spouse's needs to the best of your ability, or making deposits into their emotional love bank. But at the same time, you have to make sure that you are careful to protect your spouse. And by that I mean you avoid hurting them or offending them or embarrassing them unnecessarily. You want to avoid making withdrawals out of that person's love bank. Now, this basic concept, this paradigm, and there's going to be a one-page sheet that summarizes this paradigm, and I want everybody to pick one of these up on their way out today. I've already appointed a couple of gentlemen to help us get this done this evening. And I want you to look at this because there's tremendous profundity, I think, in this simple paradigm that I'm going to explain tonight. And the details of which are listed in your handout, God's Wisdom for Happier Homes. And at the appropriate time, I'm going to give you some page numbers that will help you kind of see how I want you to use these handouts, hopefully in the future, to help other couples and perhaps help your own marriage as well. I first ran across this basic concept from Dr. Willard Harley and a best-selling book. It sold over 3 million copies called His Needs, Her Needs. And the subtitle to this particular book is How to Affair-Proof Your Marriage. And the idea is, if you can really learn what your spouse's needs are, and both of you are determined to become experts in meeting those needs to the best of your ability, then your marriage is going to be strong, and your spouse isn't going to stray or even be tempted to be strayed, because why in the world is somebody going to run down the street and steal somebody's VW if they got a Cadillac in their own garage? And there's just some really good, helpful insights in this book, His Needs, Her Needs. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have read this book or are familiar with it? Let me see your hands. Okay, a small percentage of you. This is worth picking up. You can probably get it pretty cheaply on Amazon.com. It's one of the best books on marriage, in my opinion. And this, His Needs, Her Needs, needs to be put together with another book that is not as popular called Love Busters. And the subtitle for Love Busters has to do with protecting your marriage by avoiding habits that destroy romantic love. And so here are the two keys. The first, again, is to learn how to care for your spouse by meeting their needs to the best of your abilities. And then secondly, to protect them as much as possible. And both of these are worth reading and thinking through, because there's lots of really good practical advice in them. The problem is, I've talked to a lot of my preacher's friends in particular, and some of my marriage counseling friends, and, you know, they're almost all biblically based. And the problem is, there's some pitfalls in some of Harley's work. And I want to tell you up front that Harley has some things that are just dead wrong. For example, he does not recognize or even talk, when he talks about the 10 needs that people have in marriage, he doesn't even talk about spiritual needs, which of course is a huge omission. He's not a Bible believer, and these two books, though for the most part very helpful, are written to a broader audience. And though he uses a lot of biblical principles that work, he doesn't give God the credit. He does not recognize spiritual needs, and he does not accept the concept of headship or submission. He believes that a woman being in submission to her husband is archaic and was just a part of the cultural time of the first century and is not applicable in the 21st century. And he has several discussions where he basically believes in an egalitarian marriage, which is where there's really no role distinction at all. There's no final arbitrator of disputes or no tiebreaker. And I believe God very clearly would have us to have a traditional marriage where the husband is the head of the house. And we just sang about that in that wonderful hymn, God Give Us Christian Homes. So even though a lot of what he does say is very, very good, he doesn't back it up with Scripture. So what I have done in this little primer that I put together is I've taken the essence of Harley's paradigm and I put the Scriptures to it. So when you use this, you can read Bible principles together to the couple. And I have excised out of it part of it that is, I think, secular and unscriptural. And what you have left is something that is really powerful. And if you want a complete primer, you can go to the website for oldhamwoodschurch.com and you can download the entire primer there. And most of that, though, I've included for you in the notebook of handouts for this week's meeting. And you can see a big section there where I talk about marriage principles that work. A lot of my preacher friends have thrown out Harley completely for these reasons. But don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because if you just tweak this appropriately, this is the best practical thing you can do to help most couples. And it's just been wonderful to go through some of this and to see the light go on and to have couples suddenly have hope in their eyes again as they recognize principles about their relationship that they didn't understand before. Now, in the time allotted this evening, we're going to talk first about how to keep passion and love alive. That's usually what couples are interested in when they're in trouble. How do I have a marriage that's passionate? How do I have a marriage that is thriving rather than just kind of marking time? We're going to talk about that. I think that's important. Secondly, we're going to talk about the importance of habits. And thirdly, how to overcome love busters. Let's look first at true love. Obviously, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, beginning at verse 4, defines for us what love is all about. And I think we need to appreciate the fact that in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, love is clearly described here as a decision. It is a determination to act in a certain way. And I believe it is certainly true that couples need to, just out of their own personal character and their own commitment to God, be determined to follow these principles in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And if you act in these ways, hopefully these feelings will follow. And I'll tell you this, I am a firm believer that it's a whole lot easier to act your way out of a sense of obedience into feeling better than it is to feel your way into acting better. But again, the thing that most couples want is this strong feeling of attraction and appreciation and love for one another that initially drew them together, that over time many couples feel like they have lost. Well, how do you determine how you feel about your spouse? Enter Harley's Love Bank. Because this always explains and is an accurate barometer of how you're doing if you exclude sickness or chemical imbalance or maybe mental illness. If you take those things out of the picture, this is about 100% correct, and it is a very useful tool. The idea is very simple. You meet someone, and you set up an account in their name. And this is true with anyone you meet. It doesn't have to be a member of the opposite sex. And the next time you meet them, you probably don't have a lot of emotion attached with that encounter because they're just an acquaintance. But after a while, you get to know this person, and hopefully you have some positive exchanges. Maybe they make you laugh, they make you feel good, you have good conversations, you have a lot in common. What you're doing is you're making positive deposits into each other's love units. You get to know each other better. And it's kind of hard to define, but at some point, that acquaintance becomes a friend. And now if something were to happen to them, you'd really be sad because this person's become important to you. And so, how does this apply to the romantic relationship? Well, you meet someone, you get to know them, hopefully you start depositing love units into each other's account, you start complimenting one another, enjoying each other's company, going out on dates, having fun, laughing together. Boy, enjoying each other's company is a way to really make deposits in each other's love bank. And this hopefully goes on for a long time until ultimately you reach a certain threshold and then you, what we call, fall in love. And usually when a person falls in love, they're saying, I've never had more deposits in my love bank. Nobody's given me this much. I've never been this head or over heels over anyone in my life. And you just enjoy their presence because the pleasing acts are so much higher than the displeasing acts. But of course, no relationship is perfect. Nothing goes straight up. And every relationship at times has negative exchanges. You frustrate one another. Maybe you're short with each other. Maybe you have an annoying habit that bothers the other person. All of those things make withdrawals from the love bank. And couples have been married for many years. Every day, every week, every month, they're making deposits and they're making withdrawals. And how that's going over time determines how you feel about one another. And when the love bank is full, life is sweet. And you feel really good about this relationship. And you enjoy each other's company. This is where you enter into romantic love. And there is a natural instinct to please. It comes easily, it's pretty effortless, and we've all been there and done that. If we have fallen in love and gotten married and know how simple it seemed to be, at least in the beginning. The problem is people expect that sense of love and attraction to continue on in what we refer to as marital bliss. Because we expect the kind of behaviors that caused a lot of deposits and very few withdrawals to continue throughout marriage. But sadly, what happens to most marriages, if they don't make a special effort to avoid this, is that you get busy in your job and the wife gets busy with the children and maybe her job and life is filled with lots of things to do and you stop really thinking about what can I do to please my spouse. One writer said that the problem with many men is they stand at the altar and instead of saying, I do, they think to themselves, I'm done. You know, I don't have to woo her anymore. I've already got her. I proposed and she said yes. So now I can move on and climb the corporate ladder or do something else. Big mistake. We need to understand that positive exchanges make deposits, negative exchanges make withdrawals. But if you make too many withdrawals and you stop really making big deposits, or if you just really don't bother to make very many deposits, but you just over time make little withdrawals here and there. Maybe there's a unfinished home improvement project that goes uncompleted for a long, long time, and the wife is frustrated, and every time she sees it, it's a withdrawal from the love bank. You know what I'm talking about. And what happens if you continue to write checks out of your checking account, but you're not making big deposits? Eventually, what's going to happen? The bank account's going to go empty. And when that happens, you wake up one morning and you look across at your spouse and you think, I don't love you anymore. I don't feel about you the way I used to. And unfortunately, in our culture, that often means maybe I need to dump you and find someone else that will give me this kind of attraction and this kind of feel. And they don't realize that it's just all about the love bank. And what happens if you continue to write checks on an account that's empty? Well, now you're overdrawn. Now you have to pay a bunch of heavy bank fees, don't you? Now you're really in trouble. What happens when you still don't make deposits and you continue to make withdrawals in a marriage? Instead of just saying, I don't love you like I used to, now you can't stand to be in the room with the other person. Now you're filled with anger and bitterness and resentment. Things are going from bad to worse, and ultimately you decide, I want a divorce. And the reason you want a divorce is because you have withdrawn, usually in both accounts by this time, the reserve that you had built up from prior deposits. People tend to think their relationships are unique, and I guess in some ways everyone is different than the other, but I have found that most of the time, most everybody's relationships in this regard, in regards to the love bank, is pretty much the same. And this is something we need to relate to and understand and deal with. And I want you to know that this is a great communication tool. When my wife and I learned about this about 15 years ago, and we would talk about it, I find it really helpful. I'll say, now, if I do this for you, honey, will this be a big deposit in your love bank? You know, scale of 1 to 10, what's this going to do for you? You know, I want to know. Or if I'm doing something and she's kind of said, oh, I wish you wouldn't do that, but I'd still like to do it. I say, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much is this going to set me back? Because I know the key thing is at the end of the day, I've got more deposits and I got withdrawals. And I'm always wanting to, you know, make sure that I'm making deposits, because I know the damage, even if it's kind of small or seems innocent, I know the damage that can come from regular withdrawals and how that can take a toll on our relationship. And my wife and I will talk about that. And sometimes, you know, something's pleasing and I'll think to myself, cha-ching, 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 you know, here we are making these deposits. That's what it's all about. And ladies and gentlemen, if you can focus on the love bank and focus on your spouse and make sure that you have a lot more deposits and withdrawals, that is the simple key in most circumstances to a very happy marriage. It's really not all that complicated. And it's something that you ought to start using as a good communication tool. You also need to understand, we live in a culture that propagates the romantic myth. And this is the idea that most people in our culture believe, and our popular culture and our movies promote this all the time, but there's no basis for it, sociologically or biblically. And that is the idea that once you fall in love, if it's the real thing, you'll never lose it. And couples stand there at the altar and they think, boy, it's you and me, babe, against the world. And we've got something so special and so strong, regardless of all the other people who didn't think we should do this and we shouldn't make this mad rush to the altar. It doesn't matter, because we just know we're going to be different. Every couple feels that way. You know what? There's something that ought to be staring them in the face that lets them know that in spite of the fact we tend to feel that romantic love, particularly in its early stages, is so strong, there's just nothing that would overwhelm it, take it away. The approximately 50% divorce rate in this country ought to let people know that that's not so. The truth of the matter is, romantic love is very important, but it is incredibly fragile. And it's not understanding that causes so many people to divorce and be unhappily married. And there's another side to this romantic myth. The first is, once you possess it, you feel like you can never lose it. And the second is, people feel like once they lose it, they're just sure it can never be regained. They think once they fall out of love, or they wake up that morning and the love bank is empty and they think, I don't have any feelings for you anymore, they think my life is doomed to misery because I'm stuck living with someone that I don't love anymore and that doesn't love me anymore. And how can I be happy without a good love, romantic and good sexual relationship to come home to? And so they find themselves making all these types of excuses to get out to find someone else. It's amazing to me how many people, sadly, you know, most people in our culture don't give up on love. And they don't normally give up on marriage. They're quick to find someone else to marry. But how sad it is that they are so quick to give up on their first love. On the one they stood there at the altar and made their vows to. And that is where you have your greatest hope for fulfillment and happiness. And what couples need to understand is there tends to be an ebb and flow to this, and romantic love can be reborn. I've seen it happen all the time. And it's real simple. You want to start loving your mate again? You want to start falling in love again? Stop making withdrawals and start making deposits. And your feelings for the other party will come back with a vengeance. You know what that tells folks? If you can explain this to them in a way they can understand it? Hey, there's hope. I thought I was in this trap where I used to walk down the beach holding hands, and now I feel like I've been in handcuffs and I want out. That's a terrible feeling, but it doesn't have to be that way. If you just apply these principles, there is hope. Jesus said, all things are possible with God. Paul said in Philippians 4 and verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And sometimes when I'm dealing with a couple in my office, usually try to focus in primarily on working with Christian couples, because the only kind of counseling I know how to do is biblical counseling. But I look to these two Christians, and they look at me just disheartened, and they say, I don't know why we should stay together because our love is just dead. And I love to look over at them and remind them that as Christians, we serve a God who specializes in the resurrection from the dead. Isn't that right? And if our whole faith is based upon Jesus coming forth from the tomb, and he's the first fruits of them that slept, and one of these days we all can come forth from the tomb, if that's true and that's so core to our faith, don't you think that same God that can one day raise you from the dead, literally, can take your marriage and your love that maybe has become cold or has died and can resurrect it as well? What you have to do is understand the biblical principles, understand this paradigm, commit to the process over time, and the feelings will return. You all are going to be fine and so much better off than if you start toying with the idea of divorce and having a broken home. I am your constant companion. I am your greatest helper or heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I am completely at your command. Half the things you do, you might just as well turn over to me, and I will be able to do them quickly and correctly. I am easily managed. You must merely be firm with me. Show me exactly how you want something done, and after a few lessons, I will do it automatically. I am the servant of all great individuals and, alas, of all failures as well. Those who were great, I have made great. Those who are failures, I have made failures. I am not a machine, though I work with all the precision of a machine, plus the intelligence of a human. You may run me for a profit or run me for ruin. It makes no difference to me. Take me, train me, be firm with me, and I will place the world at your feet. Be easy with me, and I will destroy you. Who am I? I am habit. You want to understand a principle that will help you in all of your relationships, particularly your marriage? One writer said that habit is a cable. We weave a thread of it every day, and at last it can't be broken, or seems that way. The concept of habit is biblical from start to finish. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 7, exercise, discipline yourself unto godliness. Proverbs 4 and verse 26, make level the path of thy feet and let all thy ways or habits be established. Why are habits so key? Because habits determine most of our behavior. And the keys to a successful marriage has to do with establishing habits that make deposits and that don't make withdrawals. When you leave the assembly tonight, you're going to find some forms that I've given you. And you fill out those forms and you talk about it with your spouse and you communicate openly what your needs are. And then you focus in on meeting them and get feedback. And when people begin to understand this, it's just amazing how the light goes on and they understand the things they need to do to be happily married. So the challenge is to learn to habitually meet each other's needs. And what most people do is they go through four stages. What I want you to understand is very few times does somebody wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I'm going to completely neglect meeting my spouse's needs today. Or you know what, I'm going to do something to hurt my spouse's feelings today. I mean, that doesn't happen. But you know what does happen is that often we are unconsciously incompetent. And that is, we're going about our life and our ways, and we're doing things that are making withdrawals and offending our spouses. And sometimes due to lack of communication or whatever, it goes on and that love bank is getting lower and lower and lower. And you don't even know what's happening. Unconsciously incompetent. You can't go through the exercises that I'm going to suggest you go through in the material I'm sharing with you and be unconsciously incompetent anymore. What will happen once you go through this material is you become oftentimes consciously incompetent. Now, at least, if you forget to praise your wife or you forget to be attentive like you need to, at least now, hopefully, it bothers your conscience a little bit after it's brought up to you. Any of you relate to what I'm saying here? Consciously incompetent. Habits are hard to change. And so even after it's pointed out, we say, I'll do better. Sometimes we don't do better for a while. You're consciously incompetent. But hopefully it won't be long until you become consciously competent. Which means you may have to think about it, but now you're going to do better about the things your spouse wants you to do. And the beautiful thing about it is after a while, about 8 weeks is all it takes, folks. Is you become unconsciously competent. You know, my wife teases me all the time about even after 30 years, I'm still in training. She says, well, I got you trained in this, and I got you trained in that. You know, and she's right. There's just a number of things that she's just, you know, told me over and over again, you know, that I'd really appreciate it if you'd pick this up after you're done using it, or you do this or do that. And after a while, you finally learn the lesson, and you become unconsciously competent. It just becomes who you are. And you know what happens when you do that? You wind up being totally compatible, irresistible to each other. And the real focus is to listen to each other without being defensive and to figure out how you can practically develop the kind of habits that will cause you to be compatible. Now, in the time we have left, I want to talk to you just for a couple minutes about what Harley calls love busters. These are things that make withdrawals. Angry outbursts, disrespectful judgments, annoying behavior, selfish demands, and one of the worst, dishonesty. Now, as someone who's trying to look at their marriage or trying to help somebody else improve their marriage, the question you have to ask yourself is, well, what do I do first? Do I first focus on learning how to meet my spouse's needs? Or do I focus first on making sure that I avoid making withdrawals? I want to tell you, the first thing you have to do is identify and stop the love busters. Because if you don't, there are walls of resentment that build up between you and your spouse that creates emotional or spiritual divorce. And everybody becomes spiritually divorced from their spouse before they decide they want to get physically divorced, right? And the reason is, typically, there are these love busters or withdrawals that have become bricks, unresolved conflicts that haven't been dealt with. And after a while, you get one brick on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, and you wake up one day and you got this wall between the two of you. And you're two strangers living in the same house. And you're not connecting, and you're not meeting each other's needs. And the sad part about these walls is they keep negatives out because you put the wall up so that the person can't hurt you anymore, but that wall that's there as a coping mechanism keeps out the deposits as well because you are emotionally withdrawn from your spouse. So when you deal with a couple in crisis, you have to first find out who has the wall up and identify those bricks, those unresolved offenses. And then you have to ask forgiveness of each other and try to get the wall down. Because if you don't get the wall down, there's absolutely no way that it does any good. And you know, this is true for parenting. Consider Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. I don't know if you ever thought about this, but the very first thing that the Holy Spirit, through Paul, says you need to do, he says, "Fathers, first and foremost, provoke not your children to wrath." In other words, first priority is avoid making withdrawals. Avoid so exasperating or irritating or over-disciplining your children that there's a wall up between you and your kids, which breaks down the communication. He says, don't do that, but instead nurture them in the discipline and admonition of the Lord. See, that's making deposits. You ever put your arm around a teenager and seen them kind of pull away? You know, you try to reach out and touch someone and they immediately pull away. Boy, that's a sign that there's trouble in that relationship. They're not going to listen to what you have to say. You can't teach them anything because they're not open to you anymore. Because they've got some offenses, probably, that they perceive you've done against them. And you have to deal with the offenses first. You have to deal with these love busters first. Then you can talk about how to meet each other's needs. So, these love busters are pretty clear. Just as in your parenting relationship, you need to not provoke your children to wrath. Obviously, the same thing is true with your spouse. Now, what exactly is a love buster? Harley defines a love buster as a destructive marital habit, which is a repeated behavior of a spouse that causes the other to be unhappy or to withdraw love units. Now, every marriage is going to have isolated incidents where they snap at each other. Or maybe you forget an anniversary. Or you do something that's annoying. Or you frustrate the other party. Welcome to the human race. No one has a marriage without those kind of things happening some of the time. And that's perfectly okay. Hopefully you can give each other some grace when you're having a bad day. The problem is when some negative behavior that offends or embarrasses or hurts your spouse becomes habitual. Harley says this, when negative acts are repetitious and predictable, love suffers great loss. He's exactly right about that. And the problem is when these things become habitual, a pattern, then after a while you begin to fear or dread having an encounter with this other person because you're fearful this is going to happen again. And that's what will destroy a marriage. So first and foremost, you've got to get rid of these destructive habits that will destroy your love. The Bible has lots to say about these things. Consider angry outburst. We know what that is, don't we? Your fuse is lit and you're pretty short with your spouse. This is when you use anger as a way to punish or to get back at the other party. This is dangerous because normally it's done in a harsh way. It creates disrespect and can cause someone to go inward. And this includes yelling at your spouse. My wife and I were determined that we were not going to yell at each other, yell at our kids, that we weren't going to have yelling as a mode of resolving conflict as much as possible at all. And you know what? Somebody gets in my face and they start yelling at me. I mean, I just feel degraded. I just immediately pull back, don't you? There isn't any basis, it seems to me, for resolving conflict with angry outburst where the party may immediately wilt and do what you say because they're afraid and maybe you've won the argument, but I tell you, it's a huge withdrawal from the love bank and it's not giving glory to God. There's lots of verses about angry outbursts in the scripture. Be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Proverbs 14:17, he who is quick-tempered acts foolishly. The idea is keep your temper, nobody else wants it, right? And there is one who speaks like the piercings of a sword, but the tongue of the wise promotes health. And then we have disrespectful judgments. I was doing counseling a couple months ago with a young lady who just had no idea how to properly criticize her husband. I mean, she just would get pretty vicious in her words, in her language, and not just her anger, but she would call him a lazy loser and a louse, and the guy already had trouble with good self-esteem. Well, that was really going to help the situation get better, wasn't it? I'm not saying you don't make judgments. John 7, verse 24 says, judge not according to appearances, but judge righteous judgments. But I am saying we ought to avoid judgments that discredit the other person by impugning their motives or forcing our opinions on other people. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5 says, love does not insist on its own way and does not behave rudely or unseemly. You want to know what I think is a wonderful example of this whole idea of a disrespectful judgment? Is some on the left today are accusing just about anyone who disagrees with our president as being a racist. And you know, you talk about something that just immediately poisons the discussion. Now you're attacking a person's heart. I mean, how do you know that they're a racist? Can you read their heart? What a terrible thing to accuse someone of. That's just totally unfair. It's evil surmising. It's done without evidence in most cases. People who do that ought to be ashamed. That happens in our political world. And it's sad that it's poisoned the discourse. And we need to make sure that we don't allow that to happen in our marriages. No one likes a caustic critic. Someone has said that the bloom is off the rose when you wake up and feel that your spouse, instead of being your biggest fan, is your biggest critic. This is where you impose your values on the other person. This is where you deal with them in ways that are rude or arrogant or disrespectful. I think of James that says, who are you to judge? There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. I'll give you a perfect example. Well, if you had any taste, you'd know that tie doesn't match. Or if you were normal, you'd understand that the toilet paper ought to go this way and not that way. Or worse, if it wasn't for your mother, you'd know how to cook. And you'd know how to discipline. And I want to tell you, in most marriages, those are fighting words, aren't they? The solution is to express conflicting opinion with respect and understanding and work on respectful persuasion and not put-downs. How much better to say, honey, you know what? I think this tie goes better. What do you think? See, you can get across the message without a disrespectful judgment attacking the other person. Annoying behaviors. This is a behavior that is repeated without thought or concern that bothers the spouse. It does something that irritates the other party consistently. I think in Proverbs 26, verse 14, he who blesses his friend with a loud voice and rises up early in the morning, it will be counted as a curse to him. Well, that would be rather annoying if you're someone that's not a morning dove, and the morning dove is constantly singing in your ear when you're trying to sleep. Do you do things that sometimes irritate your spouse? Research has found that women tend to find men more annoying than men find women. And when you bring this up in discussion, women tend to say, well, that's just because men are just more annoying than we women. And the men say, no, it's because we men are more tolerant and understanding than our female counterparts. You know what? I'm not going to even weigh in on that argument. I'll just tell you what other people say. But if you dog-ear the pages of your wife's books, she may find that pretty irritating. Or if it's important for you to be on time and your spouse makes you late, that can be a withdrawal from the love bank. One wife complained about her husband's posture. Or maybe the tapping of the fingers at the table, or the jiggling of the leg in a way that over the years kind of gets on your nerves. One guy had a tendency to fall asleep on the couch, and then his mouth flops open. And his wife comes home, and there's the husband laying on the couch with his mouth open. He's asleep making these withdrawals from the love bank and doesn't even know it. That's how fragile romantic love is. And some women, of course, can primp for hours and take forever to get ready. And the husbands just are exasperated by that. Now, usually what happens is somebody says, well, you shouldn't be so easily annoyed. The person who has the habit that annoys the spouse always wants the other person just to kind of accept me the way I am. And you know, maybe they shouldn't be so annoyed. I understand that. But let me tell you, whether you like it or not, annoying habits over time can make steady withdrawals from the love bank that can affect how you feel about one another. It's usually better to make a commitment to be considerate and to be very careful about the love bank and do what you can to try to avoid those behaviors that irritate your spouse. And in most marriages, I'm talking to the men here rather than to the woman. And then, of course, selfish demands. This is commanding your spouse to do things that benefit you at the spouse's expense, which implied threat of punishment if they refuse. Demands choke out the feelings of love. You can have a slave or you can have a lover, but you can't have both. Threats, lectures, manipulation build resentment and causes the other party discomfort. And remember, 1 Corinthians 13:5, love does not insist on its own way. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition, Paul says, but let each of you look out not for your own interest, but also for the interest of others. So ask how the other party would feel about something before moving forward. And the last love buster is dishonesty. Marriages have to be based on radical honesty. And even if you've done something about which you shouldn't, the worst thing you can do is lie about it, try to cover it up, because the cover-up's always worse than it is if you just own up to the mistake to begin with. Obviously, this breaks down trust. Once your spouse catches you lying, they don't know what the next thing you say is as far as whether it's truthful or not. And it puts a huge question mark over their heads. Who wants to live with a liar? Who wants to live with somebody you can't trust? The key is to reveal to your spouse your thoughts, feelings, habits, likes, dislikes, personal history. Tell them everything they have the right to know. And in a marriage, that's just about everything, because you ought to live your life together. Dishonesty. Therefore, put away all lying. Each one speak the truth in love to his neighbor. Do not lie to one another, and all liars shall have their part in the lake of fire. So, all these love busters, they need to be things that you work hard on avoiding if you want to have the right kind of relationship. The key is to communicate clearly without being defensive, and use these forms that I provided for you. On the back of this particular handout on page 27, there is some material there about rating his or her love busters. And on page 28 and 29, there's an explanation of the top 10 emotional needs and how you can rate those. And if you'll go through this process and communicate these things in a way that God intends, I can guarantee you, you'll be able to have a marriage, not that is perfect, but that will enable you to live happily ever after and be a part of that top tier that says, I find my marriage highly emotionally satisfactory. If you can say that and give God the glory, you'll be so much more fulfilled and happier. And you'll have all this excess energy to serve and to evangelize and to do all these other things that God has called us to. As we said at the very beginning, the key is transformation. And the transformation comes in the doing, in the application. And may God bless each of you as you use these tools, if you're married tonight, in your own marriage. And then hopefully grasp these insights and now have something that you can share with a couple who needs the message of hope and needs the practical tools that can help them on a path that will restore their love and their mutual respect for each other based on God's principles. So, we've covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time. I wish we had more time, but I hope this is clear and that you'll find it helpful to you. The invitation song has been selected and talks about Jesus, I believe. Jesus coming into your life. Remember, Jesus is the bridegroom, faithful and true, and he says, come. And if there's anyone here who needs to come to Jesus, won't you come? As together we stand and we sing.